The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we hear from researchers who are exploring the travel patterns of snails, dogs, and mammoths. Well, our journey isn't so much on what we might see above ground. Rather, it's kind of what we see underneath, or what lies beneath, you should say, or I should say, sometimes not readily seen by the occasional tourist. Now, recent discoveries of things underground not only give us more insight into the history of a given place, but also provide some opportunities for further exploration. Now, our travel science journey today begins with an article titled, "A Near-Extinct North Carolina Snail is Back in the Wild." This article is about a tiny creature and efforts by scientists to enable this species to continue thriving in the years ahead. Our location is near Wilmington, North Carolina, and the article, published in the December 2nd, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. And our writer is Adam Wagner. A small shed-like creature built in the longleaf pine forest, a stone's throw from the Andy Woods Hampstead home, is one of the last places on Earth that the magnificent ram's horn snail can be found. For more than 30 years, Wood has protected the species, which is only found in the lower Cape Fear River Basin, by creating a habitat that is growing increasingly rare. He's installed freshwater tanks and filled them with spatterdock water lilies while diligently keeping frogs, turtles, and other predators away. Over time, that's evolved into what Wood calls Snail Central, a wood-frame structure with sliding doors that contain five large blue plastic tanks. Numerous other tanks sit outside, many covered in black mesh as Wood works to transfer snails from them into the indoor tanks. By encouraging people to think about this small snail, Wood hopes to raise awareness of broader conservation needs and of how human activity is threatening the region. Yeah, this is a story about snails, but the bigger story is about the Cape Fear River and what we've done to it and its adjacent bottomland hardwood swamps. Those swamps have been decimated and altered and damaged by saltwater intrusion, Wood said. Wood's work is paying off. The North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission now manages its own captive population, and its Conservation Aquaculture Center in Marion and North Carolina State University manages another population. Recently, the Wildlife Resources Commission started reintroducing snails to the wild for the first time in decades, a step biologists and advocates hope will play a pivotal role in the species' recovery. The reintroduction is a bright spot in a conservation field marked by gloom. Amelia Omerberg, the Wildlife Resources Commission biologist who works with the snail, told the News and Observer, quote, "This has been a really exciting for a lot of people to see potential for success and excitement of being able to take the first steps in the process of successfully recovering the species," unquote, Omar Berg said. Now, reintroduction is crucial to the species' long-time survival. Will Harlan, the Southeast Director and Senior Scientist for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "We need to get them into the wild. We need to get them reproducing in the wild and have large populations established strongholds so that these captive breeding facilities are essentially the last step and not the lifeline that they are right now," said Harlan, who has long lobbied the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for additional protections for the snail. Earlier this year, that would have been 2023, the Fish and Wildlife Service formally determined that the snail is an endangered species and designated for critical habitat for it. The agency has prepared a recovery outline and expects a full plan to be available within 18 months. Rescuing ram's horn. Now, even at its peak, experts believe magnificent ram's horn had a small range along the Cape Fear River. Biologists like Wood think it lived in beaver ponds, which were largely wiped out in the early 20th century. The four places the snail has been spotted in the wild, Greenfield Lake in Wilmington and three Brunswick County ponds, were formed by old mill dams. For a time in the mid-1900s, biologists believed there was a chance the snail was extinct, but a 1970s article in the book Threatened and Endangered Species in North Carolina noted that the small snail could still be living in some refuges like Orton Pond near the Cape Fear River. Bill Adams, who was a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers biologist, had a chance to sample the pond for salinity around 1987 and decided to look for the snail. Within 10 minutes of first dipping his net in the water, Adams pulled a snail out. I started poking around, and sure enough, there it was, Adams, who is now a pastor in Greensboro, told the News Observer. Adams contacted the Smithsonian to say the snail was still alive and submitted pictures and an article about his findings to the Nautilus, that's a New York-based science magazine. Soon after, he reached out to Wood. The history of these mill ponds was when a good hurricane comes through and drops 20 inches of rain and blows the dam out. Who knows what you've got? So I wanted to get at least one population that was sustainable that I could guarantee was there, Adams said. Adams and Wood spent much of the summer of 1992 looking for snails who could be brought into captivity. They searched every pond they could gain access to, dipping their nets in and checking slow-moving areas. They spent the most time looking around the spatterdock water lilies where the snails were likely to lay their eggs. Finally, on a blistering hot August day, they found 37 snails on a Brunswick County pond. Wood took them to the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, where he worked, and those snails are where the rescue of the species began. It was lucky that they did. Days after Hurricane Fran struck in 1996, the pond's owner called Wood to say the dam had blown out and salt water was washing in with every high tide. Snails were immediately wiped out of that pond, and I sampled in the multiple years and multiple times and haven't found them since, Wood said. A charismatic snail. Now, the magnificent ram's horn is a lunged snail that has only been found in the lower Cape Fear River basin. Its defining features include a shell that spirals on both sides and often features leopard print spots. The snail lives for about 2 or 3 years, and when fully grown, its shell is about 1.5 inches wide and 1 inch tall. Wood views the snails and other small species like it as a rivets in the ecosystem. Without protecting these smaller creatures, he warns, the larger species that depend on them will face significantly more peril. Snails, like the magnificent ram's horn, eat plant matter in water, digesting it and then pooping it out. Wood said their refuse is then available for plankton, which feed small fishes and gradually work their way up the aquatic food pyramid, all the way to largemouth bass. If you don't start at the bottom, we have no hope of protecting what's at the top, Wood said. Everyone who works with magnificent ram swarm seems to have a favorite fact or feature. For Omerberg, it's the shell and features the snail exhibits when it pokes out of the opening. It's really kind of charismatic looking. It's got almost facial features, and it's quite magnificent, Omerberg said. For Adams, it's that the small snail actually goes blind as it grows older. Why anything would ever just go blind as part of its natural history is pretty bizarre, Adams said. Bringing the snail into captivity has helped researchers understand the threats it faces. Before 1992, the snail had been seen, but nobody had spent time observing it. Wood quickly realized just how vulnerable it is to salt. He put the snails in a tank at the Fort Fisher Aquarium, perched near the Atlantic Ocean. A week later, Wood checked on them, only to find the snails drawn within their shells at the bottom. I instantly had one of those light bulb moments, Wood said. He realized that the salty air at Fort Fisher was affecting the fresh water and that the snails were dramatically susceptible to its presence. Wood took the snails to his then home in Wilmington and commandeered a blue wading pool that belonged to his sons, who were then 3 and 5 years old. I said, "Sorry, guys, this is for snails now." That was the first snail tank. It's just graduated over time, Wood said. Safe Harbor Agreement and Wildlife Resources. The magnificent ram's horn is one of 21 endangered or threatened aquatic species the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission is working to reintroduce using a safe harbor agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Rachel Hoke, the Wildlife Resources Commission's Conservation Aquaculture Coordinator, likens reintroducing species to the wild to placing eggs in more baskets. If something catastrophic happened, like a hurricane wiped out the habitat, and that was the only place that you could find the species, you don't have redundancy. So by having more populations on the landscape, those species have a greater potential to exist and thrive, Hoke said. In the case of the magnificent ram's horn, reintroduction first meant finding a pond that has slow-moving or still water, a natural pH level, and no salt. That's a tough ask in southeastern North Carolina. Ram's horn is difficult because it faces a lot of challenges, being so coastal and having the saltwater intrusion coming in, Hoke said, adding that the small snail lives dangerously close to salty areas for species that is so intolerant to those environments. Omerberg has been tasked with finding those ponds and then monitoring the snails. The first reintroduction happened in October when about 800 snails were placed in a Brunswick County pond on private property. That pond is within a snail's historical range, but it's not one of the places where snails were found previously. To prepare the pond, Omerberg and Wildlife Resources Commission staff put agricultural thyme in the water to help keep its pH, levels neutral, and then planted native aquatic vegetation for the snails to eat. Omerberg checks on the snails by donning a wetsuit and diving, carefully pulling herself along the bottom by her fingertips to avoid crushing the tiny creatures. She searches for snails and eggs, noting where they're located and how they're acting. It's been a long time since they had free rein to a natural environment, so we're just learning a lot right now about what they'd do given all the options, Omerberg said. They're doing well enough that the commission recently put 2,000 more snails in the pond. The next hurdle will be how they handle the winter months, as the snails go dormant when the water grows cold. Depending on survival numbers and reproduction success in the spring, then I think we'd start discussing further introductions, Omerberg said. Aided by the Safe Harbor Agreement, Omerberg is looking for more ponds where the snail can be reintroduced, and under that agreement, private landowners agree to work with the Wildlife Resources Commission to make their property available for the reintroduction of threatened and endangered species. Wildlife officials see it as a key tool in a state where much of the land is privately owned. We have to do this together in order to actually conserve species in their habitat, Hoke said. The end goal, Hoke added, is to reintroduce the species to their native habitats and recover them to a point where monitoring and conservation efforts aren't needed. Threats to ram's horn. Now, Wood is worried that even if they're reintroduced to the historic areas where they live, the magnificent ram's horn will face the same threats anew. And he notes, those challenges threaten other species and even pose some challenges to humans in the lower Cape Fear River area. For example, the magnificent ram's horn is tremendously sensitive to changes in water quality and to the saltwater intrusion caused by climate change. As sea levels continue to rise, saltwater will spill into more land and push further up the creeks that feed into swamplands bordering the Cape Fear River. Bleached cypress trees are a sentinel of this situation throughout the region, and the Fish and Wildlife Endangered Species Notice adds, higher temperatures and longer periods between rains will likely lead to more demand for and stress on the freshwater that magnificent ram's horn need to survive. Now, for now, the Fish and Wildlife Service has identified Orton Pond and Big Pond as critical habitats for the snail, water bodies that total 739 acres. Adam and Wood have found magnificent ram's horn in both ponds. The agency could also introduce the species to two other ponds within the historical range as part of its recovery, according to the listing. Advocates worry those habitats aren't enough. They're simply not safe for the survival of an entire species. We can't pin this species' survival to two privately owned ponds in the floodplain of the Cape Fear River, which is already experiencing serious saltwater intrusion, said Harlan of the Center for Biological Diversity. The organization has urged the FWs to identify five more critical habitat sites, either farther upriver in the Cape Fear watershed or the adjacent Waccamaw River watershed. For now, the Wildlife Resources Commission's reintroduction efforts are focused on the places where the snail has been found historically. But Hoke said the magnificent ram's horn was lost from that area with rising sea level. We, as a resource agency, don't think about assisted migration, getting it outside of its historical range. We could lose the species from the planet. Still, Hoke said, deciding to put the species in a new place would mean not only considering whether the habitat is viable for magnificent ram's horn, but also whether its introduction would have any impact on the species already living there. Wood is also worried about the Port of Wilmington's proposed deepening of its shipping channel from 42 to 47 feet to let bigger ships containing more containers travel up the Cape Fear River. The project would allow more saltwater to flow upstream, Wood warns, threatening key habitats, including those that could be used by magnificent ramhorn. Now, for a species whose entire historical range amounts to freshwater ponds in the flat swamplands around the Cape Fear River, more saltwater poses a dramatic threat. As a solution, Wood wants any approval of the dredging to include large swaths of protected land upstream of the Cape Fear River's lock and dam number one. That would protect the snails and other species from salt while potentially offering similar habitat to the places where they historically lived. I'm hoping that the snail as a flagship will raise awareness of the importance of the little things around us. And that is enough to warrant all of this. Well, Wood said, raising his hands among the tanks and sanctuary he has built and maintained over decades. Yeah, I think so. Now, this story, by the way, was produced with financial support from the Hartfield Foundation and One Earth Fund in partnership with Journalism Funding Partners. It's part of an independent journalism fellowship program, and the News and Observer says it maintains full editorial control of the work. Well, from the Cape Fear River Basin of southeast North Carolina, we travel north to southeast Virginia, home to the well-known early English settlements found in the Chesapeake region, which include, of course, familiar locales like Jamestown, Yorktown, and Williamsburg. Bones of Ancient Native Dogs Found at Jamestown is an article written for the Washington Post by Michael Ruane and appeared in the December 30th, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. They were dogs that howled but didn't bark. They resembled foxes or wolves, and they had been the companions of Native Americans for thousands of years after their ancestors arrived with early migrants from Asia. Now, DNA that appears to be from descendants of these long-vanished canines has turned up at the Jamestown Colonial Site in Virginia, where starving settlers may have eaten them, experts at Jamestown and the University of Iowa said in December 2022. It is the proof that indigenous dogs were at Jamestown and is a link to the bones of more than 100 that were found at a Native American site nearby in the 1970s and 80s. It is really exciting, said Leah Stricker, curator at Preservation Virginia's Jamestown Rediscovery Project. Many of the discoveries made on the site support the historical record, but in the case of the artifacts like these dog bones, the archaeological material is rewriting history, she said in an email. It's also exciting that the DNA survives in some of these bones, which are 400 years old, she said. This opens up new and expanded avenues of research. Dogs are believed to have come to North America with early migrants from Northeast Asia around 14,000 years ago, experts say. The first people to enter the Americas likely did so with their dogs. Angela Perry, an archaeologist at Texas A&M University, wrote with colleagues last year, and that would have been 2021, in the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Where people went, dogs went. They were used for hunting, for warmth, for protection, as draft animals, and perhaps as companions in the afterlife. The extinct Salish woolhound of the Pacific Northwest was bred for its white fur, which was cut and woven for blankets. In some instances, native dogs were eaten. The northern Iroquois had a feast of the dogs dedicated to their war god, in which dog meat was ritually eaten, the late historian Jeffrey P. Blick has written. Other groups practiced dog sacrifice. Native dogs were soon replaced by European dogs, and almost no genetic trace of the indigenous animals remains in today's dogs, Perry said in an interview. In 1607, Jamestown became the first permanent English settlement in what would become the United States. It's located on the James River in southeastern Virginia, 160 miles south of Washington, D.C. Little is known for certain about local indigenous dogs, aside from fleeting references in historic accounts. What comes down to us today regarding the Native American domestic dog in Virginia are bits and pieces that must be stitched together from sources from 1585 to 1705, Blick wrote in a paper in 2000. The British observer William Strachey, for example, reported in 1612, the dogs, and he spells dogs with two G's in this reference, the dogs of the country are like the wolves and cannot bark but howl. Others describe native dogs as looking like foxes, black and sharp-nosed. The 19th century artist and adventurer George Catlin later wrote, the dog, amongst all Indian tribes, is more esteemed and more valued than amongst any part of the civilized world. The Indian keeps him closer company and draws him near to his heart. Few images of local native dogs survive. One animal appears in the background of a painting of an Indian village in what is now northeastern North Carolina by the English artist John White. This dates to about 1585. The painting shows a dog about the size of a fox with short hair, a long nose, and tail that curls up. The Jamestown discovery came by accident, said Arian Thomas, a Ph.D. candidate in anthropology who specializes in anthropological genetics and ancient DNA at the University of Iowa. She had been researching colonial dogs of Europe origin to see when they replaced indigenous dogs. She also wanted to see if there was a link between ancient European and modern dogs. Is a bloodhound from 1625 the genetic ancestor of today's bloodhounds in North America, she said, but data on early European dogs is also scarce. She said she learned that Jamestown Rediscovery had colonial dog bone fragments in its large artifact collection. She and Associate Professor of Anthropology Matthew E. Hill, Jr. visited Jamestown in July. They focused on teeth from seven dogs and drilled into them to see if they could collect material that would yield DNA. No viable DNA existed in four of the dogs, Stricker of Jamestown said, but DNA was acquired from the other three, and analysis showed they were likely indigenous rather than European. In addition, the bones from all three showed cut marks indicating they had been butchered and eaten by colonists, said Michael Lavin, director of collections at Jamestown Rediscovery. Jamestown settlers ran out of food in the winter of 1609-1610, what was known as the starving time, and in desperation ate dogs, rodents, snakes, and boots. There's also one account of cannibalism. It is not known how or why the colonists acquired the native dogs, Lavin said. One of the native dogs was genetically linked to a dog that was found buried with many others at the site of an ancient Indian settlement across the James River, about 20 miles upstream from Jamestown near Hopewell, Virginia, Thomas of the University of Iowa said. That's new news, Lavin said. Called Wayanoke Old Town, the site dates back several thousand years, Blick wrote. In the 1970s and 80s, archaeologists discovered the remains of 117 dogs there. It is believed to be the largest collection of prehistoric dogs from a single site in North America and perhaps in the Western Hemisphere, according to Blick. According to the European colonial records, dogs up and down the eastern seaboard were reported to howl and not bark, giving rise to the term barkless dogs, he wrote. In two cases, dogs were found buried along with severed right human forearm. The reason is a mystery. Blick speculated that the arm may have been a war trophy buried with the dog to symbolically keep the enemy at bay in the afterlife. Hill of the University of Iowa said that for Native American dogs, it had always been this kind of spiritual importance and power. They quite literally have a foot in the human world, and in the natural world, they go back and forth, he said. In another case at Wayanoke, a dog was buried with an adult woman who was found in the fetal position with the animal's remains curled up over her feet. In life, she may have used the dog to keep her feet warm during chilly weather, Blick wrote, and thus her fellow villagers felt obliged to provide her this comfort on her journey to the afterlife. Wow. Well, from Jamestown, Virginia, we're going to head northwest to Beulah, North Dakota. There in May 2023, miners discovered a mammoth tusk in Freedom Mine. Now, our story, miners saw a flash of white in the rock. It was an Ice Age mammoth tusk. It's written for the Washington Post by Daniel Wu. It appeared in the December 28, 2023, online edition of the News and Observer. It was pitch dark in a North Dakota mine, and the coal miners were up late working through an early morning shift on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. But as a bulldozer operator approached a pile of excavated debris, he was attentive enough to see his headlights catch an unusual flash of white from among the dirt and rock. He paused before sending the dozer forward and alerted the rest of his team. Sitting in the pile of rock and somehow intact after being excavated and transported across the mine by heavy machinery was the tusk of a mammoth that had been buried since the Ice Age. Its discovery by workers at Freedom Mine, a local surface coal mine near Beulah, North Dakota, in May, shocked state researchers and brought paleontologists and miners together to turn the mine into an archaeological dig site. Their work uncovered more than 20 additional bones, one of the largest discoveries of mammoth remains in the state, the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources announced in December 2023. You don't really expect to see this full curved tusk just laying there in perfect condition after being dumped out of the back of a dump truck, Clint Boyd, senior paleontologist for the North Dakota Geological Survey, told the Washington Post. Mammoths roamed North America tens of thousands of years ago, and skeletal discoveries of the mighty Ice Age beast have excited communities across the United States. But their remains are not distributed evenly. While South Dakota boasts a bustling excavation site and tourist attraction near the city of Hot Springs that has unearthed the remains of more than 60 mammoths, researchers have struggled to find comparable collections of mammoth bones in neighboring North Dakota. For whatever reason, we haven't found a lot of good specimens out of here, Boyd said. Most specimens are just a bone or two or three, and that's it. It would have stayed that way if not for the sharp eye of the crew working the graveyard shift at Freedom Mine the holiday weekend. Miners are instructed to stay on the lookout for historic artifacts or remains as they dig, said David Straley, vice president of external affairs for the North American Coal, which oversees the mine. But the discovery was still a stroke of luck. Somehow, the tusk had survived its trip through the Freedom Mine's digging operation in the scoop of a massive mining excavator and a dump truck bed without getting damaged. It was spotted by the bulldozer operator just before it likely would have been crushed or buried in a pile of debris. The coal miners did exactly what they were supposed to do, Straley said, and we're just extremely proud of them and just excited about what turned out of this thing. Boyd, the paleontologist, was alerted to the find the following week. The tusk, around 7 feet long and 120 pounds, Straley estimated, was an impressive find on its own, but it also led Boyd and a team of researchers to further discoveries at the mine. In several visits over the following months, paleontologists conducted further digs around where the tusk was excavated and discovered signs of a prehistoric stream and more mammoth bones scattered along the stream's path, Boyd said. Those details could only hint at the circumstances of the mammoth's death in a vastly different Ice Age environment. Did it drown in the water, or were its remains washed into the stream by a flood? It also meant that the mammoth's remains were incomplete, but Boyd said he was pleased the team found additional bones, including ribs, shoulder blade, and a tooth. The real prize, though, was the tusk, which Boyd said he was shocked to discover was intact after churning through the Freedom Mine's machines. The tusks, because they're so heavy and dense, tend to be kind of fragile under their own weight, Boyd said, and I was definitely surprised. Now, the mammoth remains are now being cleaned and stabilized at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck. This, according to the Department of Mineral Resources. Afterward, they're going to be put on display. The Tuscan bones don't quite rival South Dakota's collection of mammoth skeletons yet, but as officials say, it is a start. Boyd adds, it's the best Ice Age specimen that I've worked on personally. So quite some discoveries there, not only in North Dakota, but Jamestown, and, of course, just outside Wilmington, North Carolina. Well, we hope you've enjoyed your science journey today on Armchair Traveler and that you'll be joining us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.